From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the latest from Israel, where a doctor awaits the hostages' return.
You're in good hands. You came home. We're here. We'll take care of you.
And Gaza, where NPR's producer Anas Baba says,
it feels like I'm witnessing a place being born again.
Then Ron Elving on the week in politics as President Trump is set to fly to the Middle East and the U.S. government stays shut. Also, Susan Orlean's memoir of her life is the sum of the stories that she's told and the lifetime performance of cabaret star Joey Arias. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, October 11th, 2025.
News. I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The wife of a well-known Brainerd Lakes area camp director who died by suicide in jail filed a wrongful death lawsuit Thursday against Crow Wing County and one of its correctional officers. Chelsea Perkins has the story.
57-year-old Robert Bob Slaba spent 36 years as director of Confidence Learning Center in East Gull Lake, which provides outdoor experiences for people with disabilities. His February 2024 death occurred within an hour of him being placed in a jail cell after his arrest for driving while intoxicated. The suit states Correctional Officer Brandon Anderson placed him in a general population cell stocked with a sheet and a bunk previously identified by state officials as a suicide hazard, despite a, quote, overwhelming combination of risk factors. Slaba registered a 0.282 blood alcohol concentration and disclosed that he suffered from anxiety, sleeping disorders, a prior suicide attempt within the last 6 months, and past hospitalization for mental health problems. He also answered yes to multiple questions on the jail's mental health screening that, by the jail's own policy, required he be referred for an immediate mental health evaluation. Reached Friday, Crow Wing County Sheriff Eric Klang declined to comment on the lawsuit. Klang did, however, confirm the hazardous bunks had been replaced as of October 2024. The lawsuit seeks financial compensation for Slaba's errors based on two violations of his constitutional rights and his wrongful death under Minnesota law. Attorneys for the defendants will have the opportunity to file an answer to the suit in U.S. District Court. Read more about this story at KAXE.org. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
A faulty breath test may have compromised driving while intoxicated charges in at least three counties because of user error. The Minnesota Star Tribune reports that a Datamaster instrument to test blood alcohol content was installed incorrectly in Aiken, Winona, and Chippewa counties. More than 70 tests in Aiken County could have been compromised, with at least one fourth-degree DWI case being dismissed there due to the error. The error was flagged by Metro Area Defense Attorney Chuck Ramsey, who represented two clients charged with DWI in Aiken County. The BCA notified all law enforcement agencies across the state of the issue and told the Star Tribune that Aiken County had stopped using the device until the error was resolved. While not as heavily attended as the hearing at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds last week, the final public hearing for a contested boundary dispute saw at least a dozen from the Bemidji area speak before the judge. Northern Township seeks to become its own city and construct a new wastewater plant to serve properties on its side of Lake Bemidji. Nearby Bemidji is disputing this move with a counterpetition that would annex properties around the lake into the city limits. Several affected property owners spoke during the Wednesday hearing at the Sanford Center, including Ron Cooperis, who has been gathering signatures for a petition protesting the annexation. Cooperis's petition does not comment on the sewer issue.
The sewer issue kind of muddies up the big issue here, which is annexation. The real core issue here that brings us to this point is that there's been a change in fiscal responsibility philosophies through the years.
Others on the affected route supported Bemidji's annexation petition, claiming it would cost less to connect to the city system than pay the special assessments for Northern's wastewater plant. Beltrami County Commissioner Joe Gould supports Bemidji's petition. He says the city was in the right to annex as cities need to grow. He adds while the regional goal for decades has been to get sewer around the lake, there has been resistance from nearby townships to the city growing by annexation. Gould said in an interview that the differences between Northern and Bemidji are philosophical.
I think it's just the nature of rural way of life, you know. People that live outside of a city, they're used to having a little more flexibility, looser regulations. It's cultural.
Written comments can be submitted to the Court of Administrative Hearings by 4:30 p.m. on October 24th. Northern Township and the City of Bemidji are expected to continue filing items on their respective cases through December 1st, with the judge's decision not expected to come before the end of the year. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The clock has started to implement President Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza. In this initial phase, Hamas has 72 hours until approximately noon, Monday local time, to release all hostages held in Gaza. In exchange, Israel will free some 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. NPR's Carrie Kahn is in Tel Aviv. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And what have you been hearing from Gaza now that Israeli troops have pulled back?
We are seeing a massive movement of people coming out, trying to reclaim some of their lives, assessing damage, just taking in the sheer devastation and destruction of Gaza after 2 years of war. NPR's reporter, Anas Baba, who is in Gaza City, sent us amazing images and testimonies of this flood of people on foot walking amidst rubble. They're coming from south to north toward Gaza City, which has just been under this punishing, massive offensive by Israel and is in ruins. Baba says for the first time, there are no Israeli bombardments or airstrikes, and people are out trying to find shelter, clearing rubble. He says they are on the move.
It feels like I'm witnessing a place being born again. But Gazans here, they don't wait for permission to live. They carry hope like oxygen. Gaza is not only rubble. Gaza is resilience. And what I see today is people sacred and stubborn, but writing themselves back into existence.
We're now watching for a promised surge of aid through the UN allowed back into Gaza soon. That'll include food, shelters, and vital medical supplies.
And meanwhile, Israel waits for the return of 20 living and as many as 28 dead hostages. What is the mood in Israel?
There is celebration. There's hope and cautious optimism, I'd say. I was at the downtown Tel Aviv public plaza dubbed Hostage Square, where there has been a lot of hugging and adulation for President Trump for personally brokering this deal. I also spent time yesterday with the nursing director of Belinson Hospital. That's in central Israel. A third of the released hostages will be taken there. I spoke with Dr. Michael Steinman, and she says everything is ready for them. Rooms, medical care, family areas. And she also said this time will be different since these hostages released are the last ones. They will not be leaving anyone behind, which was very traumatic for those freed in the past.
I'm telling them, welcome home. Oh, so glad to see you. So glad, and you're in good hands. You're in good hands. You came home. We're here. We'll take care of you.
She says reintroducing food will be difficult and will be gradual. They will get rehab and all the medical care necessary.
What are some of the challenges ahead, Carrie?
There are a lot, but I'd say the top two are disarming Hamas and governance of Gaza after the initial hostage and prisoner detainee detainee exchange is over. Trump's plan calls for an international so-called Board of Peace to take over Gaza, which will be run by Trump and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. There are a lot of details about how that will be constituted and run. Late last night, Hamas issued a statement to say they would not accept any, quote, foreign guardianship, and that governing Gaza was a Palestinian matter. Hamas-run civil police force has already been seen on the streets in areas where the Israeli army withdrew. Yesterday, too, we heard Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talking tough like he always does, reiterating that Hamas must disarm or face a resumption of military action.
Kerry Conn in Tel Aviv, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
President Trump said he's confident the Israel-Hamas ceasefire will hold. He's expected to be in Israel Monday to speak to the country's Knesset. NPR senior political contributor Ron Elving joins us. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
How big an achievement is this ceasefire for President Trump?
We are still in the first phase of watching this agreement play out, but even now, it's a significant achievement. Just getting these parties, Hamas with all its factions, Israel with all its factions, all coming together on an agreement on these terms. So it's an enormously welcome breakthrough. And if it holds up, it would certainly be a highlight of Trump's presidency, perhaps reminiscent of the way the Camp David Accords were the pinnacle of Jimmy Carter's presidency. But we haven't seen the return of the hostages yet. We still don't know whether that will lead to the next steps in the peace plan or potentially unleash more violence. If Trump and his team can keep Bibi Netanyahu on board, and if he in turn can control his hardliners, this will indeed be a monument to peace and to Trump and his administration, and they will deserve a great deal of credit.
Staying with foreign policy for a moment, the president said yesterday he plans an additional 100% tariff on China starting November 1st or sooner. Should we take his words as policy or posturing?
China announced some new restrictions on the export of rare earths, which are minerals crucial in high-tech manufacturing. Trump erupted with promises of payback. He said he would raise tariffs 100% on everything Chinese. Now, perhaps we should be accustomed by now to this kind of threat from Trump, especially to gaudy numbers like 100%. But Wall Street took it seriously, had its worst day in 6 months with deep losses in the midst of what has been a long-running rally for stocks. So what happens next? We've seen this thrust in Perry before. Will Chinese President Xi's trip to the U.S. be canceled, and which side will do the canceling? And we wait to see how much this disrupts the most important trading relationship in the world, the relationship between the two largest economic powers.
U.S. government shutdown heading into its third week. Layoffs of federal workers have begun. When asked by a reporter yesterday how many layoffs he'd authorize, the president said a lot.
And it would be Democrat-oriented because we figure, you know, they started this thing, so they should be Democrat-oriented. It'll be a lot, and we'll announce the numbers over the next couple of days, but it'll be a lot of people, all because of the Democrats.
I think he's blaming the Democrats. What more can you tell us?
Yes, he continues to blame the Democrats, and he is openly punishing the people in blue states, whether they're Democrats or not. I think we all know at this point that the impasse between lawmakers and Congress has caused federal workers to be furloughed. But fired? Their jobs are just as mandated by legislation as they were before. They have been assured their jobs were protected and they would get back pay. Now the White House is casting doubt on both. And the cuts are concentrated in some highly sensitive departments, such as health and treasury. We've seen the figure of 4,000 already and more, and the aggressiveness of these firings is causing some heartburn among Republicans, as well as the targeted Democrats. Republicans have voters who work for the federal government, too, and even more who depend on the government for services and for other things as well.
Ron, are we reaching the point where enough people are feeling the effects of this shutdown that we can expect some movement to bring it to an end?
People are feeling it, Scott, at airports, in farm country, wherever people do business with the government in any way or depend on it in any way. Republicans had hoped those people would blame the Democrats and put pressure on them. Some do and some have. But polls show more people are blaming the president and his party. So can there be an end in sight? Yes, when both sides are willing to talk seriously about the coming cuts to health care, cuts that will hurt people in red states as much as in blue states, and very possibly hurt them more. Some of Trump's biggest counties have very high rates of dependence on Medicaid. Republicans say they are willing to talk about health care and its costs after the shutdown ends. But if they have ideas and a willingness to address this issue, people who are suffering are very likely to ask, why can't they talk now?
NPR senior political contributor Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Trafalgar, Hebrides, Fair Isle and Faroes.
The shipping forecast, the presented twice weekdays on the BBC and thrice on weekends, is 100 years old this week. It broadcasts weather forecasts for the seas that surround the British Isles. You may wonder, why don't sailors and citizens on the North and Irish Seas and along the English Channel just look at their iPhones for the weather? I probably do. But the two-minute program is heard by 6.5 million people. That is more than the nightly audience for Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Kimmel, and Jimmy Fallon combined. The shipping forecast is a fixture of British life. It has been featured in songs from Radiohead, Arctic Monkeys, and Chumbawamba, and satirized by British comics and on TikTok. Seamus Heaney saluted the show in his poem, The Shipping Forecast, in which he wrote, "Green swift upsurges, North Atlantic flux, conjured by that strong gale warning voice." The edition of The Shipping Forecast that runs at 48 minutes after midnight on BBC Four has been especially hailed for what I'll just call its restful qualities. There's something reassuring in the roll of old Oliver Twistian names you hear, Humber, Biscay, Dogger, Fisher, Fair Isle, Fitzroy, Lundy, Mallon, Rockall, Utsire, Mull of Galloway. Are your eyelids growing heavy? But the persistence of the shipping forecast may remind us of how the human voice, even crackling through static, can fire up images, memories, and feelings. Most of the millions of people who tune into the shipping forecast are probably closer to nursing a hot tea in a recliner than braving cold winds in a trawler. But that doesn't mean they won't welcome a chance to hear about waves, rains, gusts and gales, or calm waters and clear skies. So much of today's information and misinformation seemed aimed to rile the divides between people by age, class, culture and beliefs. The 100-year-old shipping forecast for 2 minutes may remind us how time and the elements affect us all. Theme to the shipping forecast, and you're listening to NPR News.
18 minutes after 7 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered, KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Blandin Foundation Strengthening Rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Sunny today, temperatures in the low to mid-60s, breezy south winds. Our lows tonight near 50. And tomorrow, breezy, mostly cloudy, good chance of showers, highs in the mid to upper 60s. For Monday, a bit cooler, sunny, highs in the mid 50s. Lake Bemidji State Park has a Fall Fest candlelight adventure this evening from 6:30 to 8. Take a short candle-lit hike to the Lavinia Group Camp for a campfire and stop by the Visitor Center for a craft, treats, games, and animals. Costumes are encouraged. And it's Pumpkin Fest in downtown Aurora today from 10 to 3. Enjoy crafts, a costume contest, wagon rides, live music, and more. Find a full schedule at celebrateaurora.com.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Dominion Voting Systems, the election technology company that's at the heart of countless conspiracy theories after the 2020 election, has been sold. Dominion machines are used in more than half the states, and the company's buyer seems to be leaning into some of President Trump's language about voting. NPR's voting correspondent, Miles Parks, joins us in our studios. Miles, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Dominion became what amounts to a household name after the 2020 elections. Remind us why.
Well, if you think back to November 2020, the Trump campaign, influential people on the right were really throwing spaghetti at the wall, trying to find a conspiracy theory to stick about why President Trump did not win that election. You know, Italian satellites, late night ballot dumps, and Dominion really got pulled into that. Here's former Trump attorney Sidney Powell talking a little bit after the election on Fox Business.
I can hardly wait to put forth all the evidence we have collected on Dominion, starting with the fact it was created to produce altered voting results in Venezuela for Hugo Chavez.
So you get a taste a little bit of the kind of accusations that were being made about the company, even though none of them were ever proven true. Fox News ended up settling a defamation lawsuit with the company for close to $800 million, and the far-right outlet Newsmax also settled a similar lawsuit for more than $60 million.
Now, I imagine none of that can be good for business. Is that why the company has been sold?
Well, we haven't heard from Dominion about the sale, but I can say the rumors have not completely died and have clearly impacted the business. You know, in 2023, a Republican-leaning county in California actually voted to get rid of their Dominion counting machines in favor of hand-counting ballots, even though it was estimated to triple their costs. And even this year, officials with Trump's Justice Department reached out to local clerks in Missouri wanting to access their Dominion machines. We aren't really sure exactly why, but it is clear that there is still a lot of skepticism about this company among people who deny the 2020 results.
And of course, that could be a big task for the buyer of Dominion. Which is who and why are they buying?
Right. So it's someone who already owns a voting equipment company and wants to expand. Scott Leindecker is his name, and he's been working in elections for decades. First as an official, he was the Republican elections director in St. Louis. And then in 2011, he started a company called No Inc. that has become the nation's largest vendor for voting check-in equipment. To acquire Dominion, Leindecker started a new company called Liberty Vote. And where it gets really interesting is how much he seems to be leaning into the right's election integrity language.
Did Liberty Vote detail how they plan to change Dominion?
So it's still a little bit unclear, but there's definitely a rebrand going on. The announcement explicitly said that they would only use domestic staffing and software development, which seemed to nod to the conspiracy theorizing about Venezuela that we heard a little bit of before. And the announcement also said it would prioritize complying with President Trump's March executive order on voting. Just to be clear, it's not like the Dominion machines are just going away. You know, government contracts are already in place, and in many cases, for many years down the road. So counties that have these vote tabulators are probably still going to use them in elections in 2026. It will be interesting to watch then how the election integrity activists, the most ardent ones on the right, take this news, considering it's just at this point a change in ownership.
NPR's Miles Parks, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Scott.
The Trump administration is throwing an economic lifeline to Argentina. Last month, President Javier Milei's party lost crucial provincial elections. In turn, Argentina's currency plunged and stock prices plummeted. This has jeopardized reforms that Milei, an ideological ally of President Trump, has undertaken to try to balance Argentina's budget and tame its triple-digit inflation. This week, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent formalized an agreement to loan $20 billion to Argentina, writing that the United States is, quote, prepared immediately to take whatever exceptional measures are warranted to provide stability. Monica DeBole is an economist with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, who specializes in Latin America and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Just 8 months ago, President Milei was at a conservative political conference here in the U.S. waving a chainsaw around on stage to symbolize his efforts to downsize Argentina's government bureaucracy. What's happened since then?
So Milei has actually been quite successful in downsizing Argentina's government, and he's been pretty successful at enacting some of the other very ambitious reforms that he had planned. Inflation did come down quite substantially. Argentina also had a very high fiscal deficit, and they managed to turn that situation around. The problem is that Argentina is a country that's quite unique because it operates with two currencies, not just one. So they have their own currency, the peso, and they also use dollars in the same way that we use dollars in the U.S. And oftentimes, because of that system, they find themselves in a situation where they don't have enough dollars for the economy to function properly. And one of the things that did spark this dollar shortage was a corruption scandal involving Milei's sister, who's actually a very key figure in his government. So that, coupled with the provincial elections in Buenos Aires, which did not go Milei's way, led to the kind of dollar outflows and hence market turmoil that we saw very recently.
What would the $20 billion in aid the U.S. will provide do for Argentina?
So it won't really do all that much. I mean, it will resolve temporarily the kind of dollar shortages that they're currently facing, which is making markets very nervous and is having an impact on the exchange rate and on their domestic currency. So their domestic currency is weakening. And when that happens, usually inflation starts to spike again. So what the $20 billion will do is provide relief to that situation. But the problem is that longer term, it doesn't solve the issue that Argentina has because of the nature of its regime. Since it operates with two currencies and since it uses a dollar as if it were their own currency, they will probably face another dollar shortage not too far from where we are now. And in addition to that, the lifeline that the U.S. is giving to Argentina now, so the $20 billion, the idea behind it is that it calms things down sufficiently for Milei to be able to navigate the next few weeks, because come October 26, there are going to be legislative elections or congressional elections in Argentina. So there is sort of a bet behind this that, you know, by sort of staving off the turmoil, perhaps that will give Milei a better chance to garner more support in Congress in the upcoming elections. And that, in turn, would pave the way for the continuation of his reforms.
There's a long history in Argentina of defaulting on its obligations. I mean, isn't the U.S. taking a big risk here?
Yes, the U.S. is definitely taking a big risk. If there is one country in the world that has surprised me in terms of the U.S. providing support to it, that country could be no other than Argentina, precisely because of that fraught history.
There's been criticism, of course, of the decision to provide aid to Argentina, especially among Democrats. Is there an argument to be made that it's in the interest of the United States to advance $20 billion to Argentina?
There's no economic argument to be made that it is in the interest of the U.S. There is potentially a geopolitical argument to be made as it pertains to China. So China has been, over the past many years, very heavily involved in the region, very heavily involved in Argentina. This, I think, has become an issue now for the administration. So the way I see the motivation for this $20 billion lifeline is to try to get Argentina more into the zone of influence of the United States and away from the zone of influence of China.
Monica DeBole from the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
A house that produces more energy than it uses sounds appealing, especially as utility bills rise. In Southern California, one such house has been around for more than a decade. It's in Hermosa Beach. NPR's Jeff Brady takes us along for a visit to the Green Idea House.
From the street, Robert Fortunato's three-story modern house with brown siding fits in with the neighborhood of expensive homes facing the Pacific Ocean. To learn how it's different, you have to go inside.
You're in the Green Idea House. It's one of the first net zero energy, zero carbon case study houses that was built for less cost than standard construction.
Fortunato remodeled a smaller 1959 house to make it a showcase for energy efficiency. That's a luxury most Americans don't have, and the Trump administration is eliminating incentives that reduces the cost. Still, there are some lessons from this Green Idea House. For example, Fortunato saved money by eliminating natural gas service. There was no need to install new gas lines throughout the house. It's well insulated and designed to stay cool without air conditioning. That saved money on installation, too. One of his primary goals was reducing fossil fuel burning, which contributes to a hotter climate.
So I'm just opening the access to the roof area, and we're just going to go up and see the solar panels.
There are 26 panels generating all the electricity the house uses, plus enough for two electric cars.
And so we really haven't had an electric bill or a gas bill in the last 13 years.
He did pay $18,000 up front to install the panels. Fortunato says with utility bill savings, he broke even in 4 years. Because his roof is flat, you can't see the panels from the street. The roof also has a 5-foot overhang on the front that saves energy by shading the house in the summer.
And then in the wintertime, the sun rides low in the sky across the horizon, and the sun goes into the windows and actually heats up the house for free.
Building a house like this requires a lot of research and planning that many Americans may not have the time and energy for. Still, Fortunato says it makes sense to constantly remind contractors and suppliers to stick to your goals. For example, he picked the brown metal siding because it was made in a nearby factory in Fontana, California. Fortunato wanted to avoid burning fossil fuels to have it delivered across the country. But when he switched to a slightly different color, the salesperson didn't mention that shade was made somewhere else.
Then he said, well, no, you ordered a color brown that only Texas makes. And then I said, well, what color comes out of Fontana? And it was very similar. And we said, well, let's go with that color.
That focus on saving energy helped Fortunato identify efficiencies in unexpected places.
For example, this garage door opener replaced an old garage door opener that used 15 watts just sitting there continuously,
waiting to sense when someone pushed the button. The new one uses 1/5 the electricity. It's not a big savings, but it's important to Fortunato. Chris Magwood wrote a book for homeowners who want a more efficient home. He says it's important to question motives to make sure a goal is actually accomplished.
Having me as a consultant is like having that annoying 2-year-old in your house, because I just go, why? Like, why a solar house?
Magwood works at the clean energy nonprofit group Rocky Mountain Institute and says if the environment is the answer, rooftop solar panels might make sense for homeowners in a state that burns a lot of coal for electricity, but may not make sense in a state that gets most of its power from cleaner sources. Magwood says building or remodeling a more efficient home takes a lot of time and dedication. It's getting easier, he says, with certification programs like Energy Star to ensure contractors and manufacturers meet efficiency standards. Magwood says if you're lucky, you might even find a local builder who has the same goals you do.
Or it might be you're the one tugging on your builder's sleeve, you know, all the time, like, hey, like, what about this? What about that? What about the other thing?
In Hermosa Beach, Fortunato had no problem tugging on people's sleeves to get the house his family wanted. Now, with those solar panels paid for, he estimates they save about $400 every month in utility and gasoline costs. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Hermosa Beach, California.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. a type of ship that's credited with helping win World War II traveled the Ohio River recently. It is the last fully preserved World War II landing ship tank still in operation. Tim Jagula with member station WNIN got to explore this working artifact.
The landing ship tank, or LST-325, usually docks in Evansville on the Ohio River. But for 4 weeks, the crew visited different cities, offering tours of the ship, which looks the same as it did in 1944.
So right here, we see this map. What is this map? This map shows you every location the ship went to during World War II.
LST-325 crew member Zach Shaw is leading a tour at the ship's first stop in Muscatine, Iowa.
All of the major turning points in school, you kids may have heard some of these names, like North Africa during Operation Torch and Salerno. This ship was there when all of those big events happened.
6,000 people paid to tour the ship that weekend, according to the museum which maintains it. And these tours support their efforts. Other stops were in Missouri and Illinois. In 1944, the ship delivered troops and tanks to Omaha Beach on D-Day.
These vessels were custom made during World War II because prior to the war, they didn't exist.
This is the last seaworthy World War II landing ship tank in the world. Traveling at max speeds of about 14 miles an hour, LSTs have been called last ship there or large slow target. But speed wasn't why the ship was important to the Allies in World War II.
I think it's very easy to say that this was the ship that won the war. Obviously, it was a much more complicated story than that.
This is University of Evansville history professor James McLeod.
But if you think about the American landings in France and Sicily and Italy and North Africa and all across the Pacific, really they were successful because the soldiers and Marines that landed were able to be supported relatively quickly with heavy equipment and tanks, and that was primarily done by LSTs.
This ship was one of about 1,000 built for the war. 167 were built right here in Evansville. The LST is powered by twin 100-year-old locomotive engines, each the size of a passenger car. The crew of mainly volunteers had to prepare the ship prior to the cruise. On the deck, the crew is untying the ship, preparing to disembark.
Ready?
All right, that's it for right now.
In wartime, the upper deck would hold lighter vehicles like Jeeps. The LST slowly turns around in the Ohio River and motors away, people waving to crew members on board.
I see you!
I see you too!
While Jeeps sat on the top deck, the cavernous tank deck below held and delivered 20 Sherman tanks into enemy territory. This feature is most striking for McLeod.
And you think what that must have been like during the moments before the ship hit the beaches, when there would have been dozens and dozens of young men in the 20 Sherman tanks that would have been lined up in that tank deck, just waiting for the bow doors to open and for their war to start.
McLeod says because so few World War II veterans remain, such artifacts are important to learn about the history and to remember their sacrifices. For NPR News, I'm Tim Jagalow in Evansville, Indiana.
This is NPR News.
It's 7:39. You're listening to People Powered KAXC and Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project. Sunny today, temperatures in the low to mid-60s, breezy south winds, lows tonight near 50, and tomorrow, breezy, mostly cloudy, good chance of showers, temperatures in the mid to upper 60s, and looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny and cooler, highs in the mid-50s, west winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour. There's an Indigenous People celebration on Monday, 4:30 to 7 at the Gitche-Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd. See the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Color Guard, a student hand drum group, and the exhibit Why Treaties Matter.
Bill Snyder with these headlines. Thousands of displaced Palestinians are returning to the ruins of northern Gaza. A huge column of people on foot began heading back after the U.S. brokered ceasefire went into effect yesterday. Israeli troops have begun pulling back, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has suggested that Israel could renew the war if Hamas does not give up its weapons. President Trump has followed up on his threat to impose a new 100% tariff on imports from China. In a social media post, Trump said the tariffs would take effect on November 1st. The initial threat led Wall Street to tumble to its worst day since April. And emergency crews are working to restore power in many parts of Ukraine following Friday's Russian drone and missile attack that targeted energy infrastructure. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Susan Orlean says, the story of my life is the story of my stories. But she's put parts of her own life into a memoir of her career as an esteemed long-form journalism storyteller, her decades at The New Yorker and her books, The Orchid Thief, The Library Book, Rin Tin Tin, and more. Susan Orlean joins us now from Rhinebeck, New York, her new memoir, Joyride. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, I want to ask you about a number of your most celebrated stories. Herbert the Nearsighted Pigeon.
Yes, this was my first published work. I was the publisher, I was the author, I was the illustrator. And I was the distributor. In other words, I wrote this when I was 5 years old. And this was a story about a pigeon who suddenly has become estranged from his friends. He doesn't understand why.
Boy, at 5 years old, an estranged pigeon?
Even at that age, I had this impulse to put stories down on paper.
You discovered later in life that your father, who was a lawyer and real estate developer, had actually dreamed of becoming a writer. Was that a spark that passed? What happened?
I think what happened is my father grew up during the Depression. Being a lawyer had the security of a professional license, a training, a career path. But my father always lived in the world with the curiosity of a writer. He liked taking us to different neighborhoods in Cleveland that when I was growing up, people didn't travel from the suburbs into the downtown of Cleveland. It was not typical. He liked talking to strangers. He liked talking to every kind of stranger, somebody highly placed in society and someone very much down on their luck. He had an appetite for learning and discovering and exploring. I think it traveled intact from him to me.
Hmm. Rajneeshpuram. This was a community founded by Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh in the early 80s, as I recall. You were working for Willamette Week. But you went there to cover the story for the Village Voice. What did you learn from an encounter with Swami Deva Wolfgang?
I learned early on how easy it is to become seduced by your subject. What I do is immerse myself into these new worlds that I want to write about. Immersing yourself, by definition almost, means you go into it open-heartedly and with a really sincere interest in learning what this world is all about. And it is very easy to begin losing the objectivity of being a reporter. You're kind of romanced by the adventure itself.
We should explain group of people who had separated from society at large.
And no prohibitions. It was fine to be rich. It was fine to drink and smoke. And I absolutely, you know, the honey caught the fly in this case, enough so that I started to feel myself losing perspective. Luckily, I had the wherewithal to stop myself and say, wait a minute, I see what's going on here. I need to distance myself emotionally a little bit and not let the romance of the moment overwhelm me.
You say at one point that you don't like reporting that relies on coded shorthand, that doesn't consider the nuance in a story, and that supposes readers share an assumption.
It's the thing that that gets under my skin the most, which is we drop these kind of code phrases and assume everybody knows what that means. During the period after the Oklahoma City bombing and after Timothy McVeigh was arrested, it was mentioned in a lot of profiles of him that he lived in a trailer park. I began feeling like, why do we assume that we know what that means? So I set out to write a story about life in a trailer park. And it was absolutely fascinating. Some of it confirmed my assumptions. Some of it absolutely did not confirm my assumptions. But more importantly, I feel like that's the role of a storyteller, to take these packed phrases and unpack them and look at them more deeply and get to the humanity behind them, so that they become more than just this phrase that we drop on a page.
Susan, how did you encounter the extraordinary world of orchid enthusiasts?
It is indeed an extraordinary world. This was a lucky accident. I was flying home from Miami, and I had finished the book that I brought to read on the plane, so I started digging around in the seat pocket, and someone had left a copy of the Miami Herald. Way back in the front section, there was this little headline that caught my eye that said, "Local nurseryman and crew of Seminoles arrested with rare orchids in swamp."
That's quite, yes, I can see what it caught your eye.
Yeah, it just was like, I have never seen these words together in one sentence. And it was a brief mention of this man, John LaRoche, who had been arrested with his crew of Seminoles in a swamp that I had never heard of, a state preserve in Florida, and they had four pillowcases full of orchids. I didn't know orchids grew wild in South Florida. I didn't know that people collected orchids. I thought if you wanted an orchid, you went to Home Depot and bought one. Every sentence in this short piece had me hungry for more. And I immediately headed back to Florida to go to the hearing. And after I published a piece for The New Yorker, I thought, there's more here. I want to write a book about it.
Of course, The Orchid Thief, 1998 book, wound up inspiring the film adaptation about a screenwriter who couldn't figure out how to adapt the book into a screenplay. Did the fact that you approached this with interest but not a lot of knowledge help you?
I think the lack of knowledge is a superpower. It brings for me this voraciousness to learn, to gobble up this world that I'm plunging into, it helps me, even though it's humbling, to say, how do orchids have babies? And have the head of the Orchid Society give you a look that is like, oh my God, we're going to have to really explain things to her. That's okay. I also feel like in that case, I'm a proxy for my reader. I am going through what they're going to go through when they read my piece, which is to say, wait, 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 explain to me, what is this all about?
Susan Norlean's new memoir, Joyride. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Scott.
At the age of 76, cabaret artist Joey Arias has done everything from sell clothes to Spanish royalty to sing backup for David Bowie. That even with that kind of resume, this creature of New York is best experienced in small, swanky, and dimly lit clubs. NPR's Ryan Bank recently did just that at the opening of Joey Arias' new residency in Washington, D.C.
So we'd like to welcome back the beautiful, the gorgeous Joey Arias.
At Northwest D.C.'s Barrel House Cafe and Bar, the petite Joey Arias slinks up to the stage wearing black leather high heels, sporting jet black bangs, deep red lipstick, and a corset pulled so tight, it's a wonder he can even breathe. He takes the mic.
Well, I'm so happy and so honored to be here in D.C. Are you feeling sexy?
It's best to go into your first Joey Arias show, sans expectations. It's musical, sure, but it's not a concert. He's surely sultry and serious, but he's also a comedian. Tonight, he's feeling a little bit rock and roll.
Hey, babe! Stop what you're doing. Give me a roll.
This, of course, is Led Zeppelin's Communication Breakdown. Just one song of a repertoire so vast, Arias calls it his Bible. It's a real, giant songbook he consults like a list of spells during his performance. It includes some classic covers, many originals, and years of handwritten notes. I'd met him the day after at his hotel lobby. He was incognito, large black sunglasses, black matching tracksuit, out of drag, and sipping a coffee. But still commanding attention. He's always loved entertaining.
I think it started when I first landed on this planet.
Arias landed in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He grew up mostly in California.
I think I was creating and reinventing myself constantly, even as a child. Even at the age of like 9 years old, I was already dyeing my hair and tweezing my eyebrows and doing weird things to myself.
Arias calls himself a shapeshifter.
People always think like, oh, I know Joey. It's like, no, you don't know Joey.
We grew up together. He was like my bestie.
If there's anyone who does know Joey Arias, it's Kim Hastrider, founder of Paper Magazine. She met Arias while a student at Cal Arts in Southern California. When she graduated, Hastrider says Arias offered to help move her to New York City. And when the pair arrived, well, he just never looked back.
He helped me move out in the middle of the night, literally.
Hastrider and Arias arrived in New York in 1976. They shared an apartment, both got jobs, and they went dancing together every night. Arias started working as a sales associate at Italian fashion brand Fiorucci's flagship store in the United States. He quickly became a draw and a mascot for the store. He was like a living mannequin who once spoofed patron Andy Warhol and played fashion consultant for the then Queen of Spain. Everything Arias did was a performance. Arias eventually made friends with German avant-garde opera singer Klaus Nomi, and he began performing with him. He even joined Nomi on stage with David Bowie as the musical guests for Saturday Night Live. This song Arias is singing is his tribute to the late Klaus Nomi, who died of AIDS in 1983.
Klaus had pneumonia, and I went to the hospital, and I had to put a paper jumpsuit on. I went in there, and he was like, looking at me, and he goes, who is it? And I was like, it's Joey. He goes, I can't see you. I took everything off, and he looking at me, and I went right up to him, and I hugged him, kissed him on the cheeks.
This was the tragic duality of this particular time and scene. So many were finding themselves in this burgeoning underground movement of artists and performers, while at the same time these blinding, colorful lights were being snuffed out as quickly as they came to life. Arias recalls losing collaborators, friends, and even lovers.
We were supposed to grow old together, but he's always guiding me spiritually, I know that.
Shortly after Nomi died, Arias' partner Chuck Smith was diagnosed. He remembers him rolling over in bed one night and whispering simply, "I have it." He died a short time later.
At that point, it was like, that was a sentence. If you said you had it, you had less than a year to live.
Arias says he doesn't really know how he made it through alive, but in the following years, he continued performing throughout New York City clubs before getting the role of a lifetime. MC for Cirque du Soleil's first adult-themed show at New York New York Casino in Las Vegas. Arias also wrote songs for the show. It was called Zoomanity.
Hello, boys! Hello, girls! Do you want it?
The show was raunchy, outrageous, and sexy. The perfect vehicle for a performer like Arias. But it was also grueling. After years of doing 10 shows a week, Arias says the show's doctor gave him prescription painkillers. He became addicted.
Things are falling apart. And before I knew it, I was like, I found myself drinking like white wine 24 hours a day.
One night, Kim Hastrider visited her friend during his show at Joe's Pub.
He was slurring. He was completely up on stage at Joe's Pub. I was like, what?
Hastrider then invited her friend to a tea party, a small get-together with a whole bunch of their old friends. It was an intervention. She helped fundraise to send Arias to rehab, and now Arias has been sober for almost 8 years.
Kim came through, and she said, I'm not going to let my best friend, this incredible artist, die on my watch.
Joey Arias has resurrected and reinvented his career, his persona, endless times over his 7 decades plus on Earth. But he says he's nowhere close to being finished.
I want to live to be at least 200 years old. There's so much I want to do. And I feel like I'm a messenger of the universe.
And he has a message he wants to share with Weekend Edition listeners.
Remember how beautiful you are. Look in the mirror. And if you don't feel inspired, seriously, go to the park, touch a tree, look at the sky.
Because whatever's happening in the world, he says, Mother Nature knows how to take care of herself.
And come to my shows, because I will take care of you too.
Ryan Bank, NPR News, Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is just before 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXC.org or by asking your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report, local news from our region. 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. This week's story is about grace. 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. And at noon, the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivi. Sunny today, temperatures in the low to mid-60s, breezy south winds, lows tonight near 50, and tomorrow breezy, mostly cloudy, good chance of showers, temperatures in the mid to upper 60s, a bit cooler on Monday, sunny skies, highs in the mid-50s. You can find a list of events happening throughout the region next week at our website. Look for events up north. More news is next on KAXE.